If I can ask Professor Martin Mortimer then to go for it.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, my thanks to Baroness Miller and Mr. Fellow for the opportunity to speak to this all-parliamentary group on agroecology. Coming second in the speaker list always suffers the possibility that someone will have picked the plums that you wanted to talk about. I'm incredibly grateful to Julia for picking plums, and I'm going to pick pears. We're going to talk about completely different things. And you might say, well, why is that? Why should I move away from the heart of what Julia talked about in terms of democratising research? What I want to do in the next 20 minutes is to look at agroecology in the context of the enormous challenge that humanity faces, in the context of our children's lifetime, if not our own, and to draw on published literature, particularly the Foresight Report put out by John Bennington and his group, Government Chief Scientist, and also draw on some experiences of my own and from my own department. I am, as you're probably aware, an academic. I spent 7 years when I had dark hair working on poverty alleviation in South Asia and Southeast Asia, working for the International Rice Research Institute, looking at rice. So I do have an understanding of some of the associated issues and the relationships to agroecology, and particularly smallholder agriculture. This is the enormous challenge that we all face, and I guess we all know it. It could well be that we are going to have simply a future of rising food prices and shortages. For those of you who can't see, this starts in 2006 and goes up to 2010. These are retail price indices for different foods. We may be seeing market volatility. As that graph shows, we may see uncertainty in supplies. And I'm talking about the developer here. In the less developed world, are we going to actually be seeing increasing hunger? This is effectively a plot of millions of people being characterised as undernourished. You can just about probably see from the back that it's going down, but then it shoots up. It shoots up with the price hike in 2008, which was the direct consequence of the issues over biofuels and the market reorientation, particularly in the States, over maize. Here are the probabilistic projections of human population globally. That's one of the major drivers of insecurity in food supplies. The consequences of demographic increase are going to be direct in terms of numbers of humans, but indirect in the consequences of their actions. And of course, the other major driver that we should never forget, which will impact enormously on food supplies, is climate change. Some of my colleagues would say we're already experiencing climate change, others may be less certain. But projections of food shortage, future shortages of land for agriculture are well known, and the demand for water for agriculture is an equally major concern. So what we're looking at here is world population growth, 2020, we're looking at the arable land available in terms of permanent crops, billions of hectares here, but notice they stabilise at 1.5, and this then becomes a farmland per person. I'm talking globally. Two major policy conclusions have come out of an awful lot of work, and the first is that limited land requires a transition to agriculture, which is high production, intensive, and at the same time sustainable with low emissions. What we call sustainable intensification. Those two words don't necessarily sit well together unless you unpack it. And then the other, which comes out of the Foresight Report, is that national self-sufficiency is not a viable option for nations to contribute to global food security. Rather, the importance lies in crafting to the food governance system to maximise the benefits of globalisation and ensure they are fairly distributed. There then are the great challenges that we actually face, and the key drivers come from that. You may disagree with them, but they are policy drivers which are influencing governments. Let's come back to agroecology. I was trained as an agroecologist. Again, let me just talk you through this slide. A lot of agroecology as a scientific discipline had its roots in a comparative analysis of how our normal ecosystems work, our wetlands, our forests, which are natural, and how they compare against agricultural ecosystems or agroecosystems, one which might have intensive inputs, for instance, and maybe perturbed on a high frequency with a routine harvesting, for instance, of arable crops. Okay, so when you start to look at some of the ecological properties, what you actually find is, for instance, that the resilience of an agroecosystem is not inherent in itself because of its biodiversity. It's determined by anthropogenic factors, by man, for instance. You find that nutrient cycling in natural ecosystems may be very high, recycling, but very low in conventional agriculture. So we move, if you like, into thinking about sustainable systems where generally these low concerns about functionality, or the functionality of natural ecosystems, are in some way elevated. And there's a spatial dimension to this, so you might argue that a typical landscape in Britain, for instance, a farmland, this is near Cheshire, where I live, is relatively small fields, it has got hedgerows, it has got rural land. And you might argue that the ecosystem properties that control pests there, insect pests, are much more powerful than they are there. That's a shot of rice monoculture in Bangladesh, where we work. Very, very large areas of monocultures. Well, I can tell you and explain to you, in fact, that the resilience to pests in those systems, which are monocultures, with very, very small amounts of uncropped land, is extremely good, despite the fact that it looks like a monoculture. We can talk about the processes and so forth later on. So, it's not that simple. It's not that simple in any means when you start to try and understand the processes that go on in terms of governing stability and production in agroecosystems. And the early proponents of agroecology emphasized the need for an integrated approach and for the necessity of considering the consequences of driving production upwards, and for the necessity of thinking about sustainability and externalities. And one of the problems in thinking agroecologically, as it's often portrayed, is that it's small scale. It works on a small spatial scale, it looks at small livelihood groups, it looks at specific little projects. They may be highly researchable and worthwhile in their particular contexts, but they don't always engage in the wider picture. And Julia gave a good example of the different choices that her Cuban farmers could actually have. They have implications over different spatial scales. That was a view in 2003, and of course agroecology has been helped enormously by embracing the idea of the ecosystem approach. And this has come from the UK National Ecosystem Assessment, which was published this year, which deliberately links and provides us with a framework of looking at drivers of change, whether they be direct or indirect, ecosystem services, the relative value, and we might get into discussion about how you value an ecosystem, a natural asset, how they provide goods, and how they link into human well-being. And that framework, which has been accepted internationally at a number of levels, is extremely effective in trying to understand how agroecosystems work and making the connections around all of those processes. It's become a long, long way. So we look at, you look at ecosystem processes, so in primary production, say growth of wheat, water cycling, soil formation, nutrient cycling. Look at the services that they provide, for instance, pollination, disease and pest regulation, climate regulation, and then the goods in the broadest economic sense, and then the values of those in terms of economic health and sustainability. Let me just illustrate some of that for ecosystem services in the Indo-Gangetic Plains. Think north of Delhi, think all the way to Calcutta. What we're looking at here is a rice wheat system, which is the breadbasket, inverted commas, of India. talking about, just across the top here, foothills of the Himalayas. There are numerous planetary services that operate there which support poor people, smallholder farmers, people who live with maybe 1 or 2 hectares of land in a subsistence way. Hydrological flows at a catchment level gives you an aquifer recharge. In much area of the Indo-Gangetic up here, you only need to go down 10 feet and you can tap water. And that's a consequence of the glacial systems in the Himalayas, feeding water back down. Massive water flows through rivers gives you soil nutrient recharge. There are significant amounts of potassium, phosphate and sulphur per season as a consequence of the river flow and sediments. In systems like this, of rice-based systems, then managing flooding at the field level by farmers can give you biological nitrogen fixation, a natural service in that flooding water, which in some cases can give you up to 3 tons of grain per hectare. In other words, if a farmer's accepting that, then he doesn't need to put any nitrogen fertilizer. Insect pest management comes very strongly because of natural predators on the edges of fields. And likewise, standing water protects the crop from weed competition. That standing water for the life of the crop can, if it was removed, could actually reduce yields very significantly indeed, up to 5 tons per hectare of grain. Those are ecosystem services. Now, the problem is that there is shortage of water in this region, dramatic shortage of water. And this is where agroecological analysis is coming in. Because if you move from transplanted rice and standing water like that, to raising a crop like that, from seed, just like you might grow wheat in this country, but on slightly saturated soil, then your biological nitrogen fixer, and you keep it in that situation, saturated but not standing water, you lose a lot of your biological nitrogen fixation, you get massive problems with weeds. It evokes the need for chemical weed control, whereas you didn't need to do very much apart from a bit of hand weeding there. And you get a whole range of other species coming in, including mimics of rice, which compete very strongly with the actual cultivar, but the farmer can't tell the difference, if you like an invasive species. What you do get, of course, is that rice fields like this produce methane. They produce a lot of methane, which is a highly potent greenhouse gas. Whereas if you work in these environments, you get not no methane, but you get less methane. So you can start to see you've changed one thing. You've just changed from reducing your water supply, the knock-on agroecological consequences are considerable. Might be better for the farmer, may not be better for the farmer. Depends where he is. Depends whether he has control of his water supplies. So let me come on to greenhouse warming potential of our crops. And this is something that we really need to think about in terms of how we think about our future agricultural production. This is greenhouse warming potential. Kilograms of CO2 equivalents per hectare per season. And this comes from, according to the States, comes from a large number of studies that have been aggregated. Here is rice pumping out methane. It's a potent greenhouse gas. It's not as potent as nitrous oxide, which is 12 times more potent. But you can see that it produces a little bit of nitrous oxide in the reservoir. Other two major crops, wheat and maize, produce nitrous oxide but no methane. Now that, you might say, is an incredibly alarming figure. We should not be growing rice. Well, try telling Asia not to grow rice. I mean, we've got some good politicians here, but I think they might even struggle. But let's turn this round a little bit. Let's look at this not in terms of gas per hectare per season. Let's talk about it in terms of yield scaled. Greenhouse warming potential, because rice is very productive and it's grown on a large area. So when we think about it on a global basis, for humanity as a whole, yes, it still produces more than wheat and maize. I've just done scaling in terms of how much production is produced, but it's not so bad. And this would then argue that if we do research, which actually looks at how you change the Green Revolution way of growing rice into dry land systems, then you can bring these greenhouse gas emissions down to an equivalence of wheat and maize. Clearly, probably far too much, because agriculture contributes about 12 to 14% of our anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. But nevertheless, we can make a major change over a very, very large area. So I'm sure I'm running out of time, but I haven't been told. That's good.
Almost.
So how to move forward from an agroecological point of view? We need to review existing paradigms. One of the key paradigms in integrated pest management is the more pesticides you put on, the more yield you get. The answer to that is yes and no. This comes from Julian Preti's work, where he looked at a very, very large number of studies which looked at whether or not pesticides have been increased or decreased in relation to yields, in relation to a whole range of different studies where the research had gone on. Situation A is where pesticide use and increased and yields increased as well. There were 10 studies where that happened. Those studies, I've got my minutes, those studies were where we deliberately went for reduced tillage and conservation agriculture to try and minimise soil losses. Doing that process resulted in more weeds and a change in the pest spectrum, and therefore, whilst you've got yield increases in practical studies on farm, pesticides went up. There are other circumstances where pesticide use dramatically went down, sometimes with a very small yield penalty, but only largely due to mistiming of the necessary amount of pesticides. In other cases, where you get massive yield increases if you reduced your pesticide use, which was just a bad understanding and perhaps some opportunistic selling by the pesticide industry. How do we move forward? That's another way I think we need to think about this. We need to think about understanding constraints to adoption. This is a farmer, Mohammed, I forget his surname now, I will call him Mohammed, working again near Calcutta, trying to grow a crop post-rice in the dry season. These are the number of decisions that he makes before he decides to sow a crop of chickpea, for instance, on drying down soils. It's not a simple process by any means. We need to understand that level of complexity before we go forward with any form of intervention. Baskets of choices are immensely important. We need to recognise as well that agroecosystems respond ecologically and evolutionarily. I'm not sure whether you're aware, but in the last year there has been a massive problem in the US. US minimum till agriculture, we're talking soy, we're talking maize, we're talking about minimum tillage and glyphosate Roundup sprayed on it. The perceived wisdom was that there would never be evolution of resistance to that herbicide. The perceived wisdom. That has changed. It's taken nearly 30 years, but suddenly there is a particular resurgence, if you like, of something called water hemp. Now, water hemp, by its very name, lived in the wet patches. It didn't live on the dry land. But the conservation tillage, with no bearing of seeds, allowed it to creep on and survive reasonably well in amongst corn and smother it here. And it's evolved resistance to Roundup and many of the other herbicides that are available. There is a situation where we, in our ignorance, assume, well, it's going to be all right, chaps. An ecological change in the way you grew crop led to an evolutionary change in terms of resistance to the pest management. And there's some data there, which I can talk about afterwards, where we have major problems. I know that time's running away. How to move forward, the need for new technologies. We may want to debate this, but GM crops, of course, had a tremendously bad press in the 90s. The science has moved on. Genomics now and the sequencing of, for instance, wheat cultivars that we've done at Liverpool means that you can take different land races, take different varieties, sequence those genomes and find the individual gene that differs that gives those traits. You can then use that to accelerate plant breeding process. This is not taking a gene from an alien species and putting it into a crop with all of the so-called Frankensteinian implications.
I can't quite believe you did that sort of argument at the time of
day,
I'm not going to take questions from the floor yet. There'll be a chance. Well, all statements.
Okay, well, I'll come back to that. I'm happy to talk about that. So finally, how to move forward. Recognising the priorities and who needs to act. My point, and I've deliberately taken this out of the Foresight report, is that we all need to be involved. We all have different roles to play. These numbers here reflect the Foresights Report's key activities that they thought, the government thought was most important. I'm not trying to emphasise the differences in numbers. I'm emphasising that we all need to be deeply involved with the processes of how we ensure food security. What we don't need to do is reinvent the wheel. We might need to use the wheel differently. And we need to think about particularly innovation, but we equally well need to think about knowledge exchange, so we actually get best practice out to the farmers and to the users of agricultural products. At least I can see I've sparked some interest. So thank you very much. We'll come back to that.
Thank you, Martin.